in the tobacco business. Keep in mind that R.J. Reynolds was under siege from society, had the same kinds of products, and faced the same tensions as Philip Morris. Yet unlike Philip Morris, R.J. Reynolds' executives began to diversify away from tobacco into any arena where it could get growth, regardless of whether they had any passion for those acquisitions or whether the company could be the best in the world at them. The Philip Morris people stuck much closer to the tobacco business in large part because they loved that business. In contrast, the R.J. Reynolds people saw tobacco as, it's just a way to make money. As vividly portrayed in the book Barbarians at the Gate, R.J. Reynolds' executives eventually lost passion for anything, at least it appears, except making themselves rich through a leveraged buyout. It may seem odd to talk about something as soft and fuzzy as passion as an integral part of a strategic framework. But throughout the good to great companies, passion became a key part of the hedgehog concept. You can't manufacture passion or motivate people to feel passionate. You can only discover what ignites your passion and the passions of those around you. You're either passionate or you're not. The good to great companies did not say, okay, folks, let's get passionate about what we do. Sensibly, they went the other way entirely. They said we should only do those things we can get passionate about. Kimberly-Clark executives made the shift to paper-based consumer products in large part because they could get more passionate about them. As one executive put it in one of my favorite quotes in the whole study, traditional paper products, they're okay, but they just don't have the charisma of a diaper. When Gillette executives made the choice to build sophisticated, relatively expensive shaving systems rather than fight a low-margin battle with disposables, they did so in large part because they just couldn't get excited about cheap disposable razors. Chief Executive Zane talks about shaving systems with the sort of technical gusto one expects from a Boeing or Hughes engineer, wrote one journalist about Gillette's CEO in 1996. Gillette has always been at its best when it sticks to businesses that fit its hedgehog concept. People who aren't passionate about Gillette need not apply, wrote a Wall Street Journal reporter who went on to describe how a top business school graduate wasn't hired because she just didn't show enough passion for deodorant. Perhaps you too can't get passionate about deodorant. Perhaps you might find it hard to imagine being passionate about pharmacies, grocery stores, tobacco, or postage meters. You might wonder what type of person gets all jazzed up about making a bank as efficient as McDonald's, or who considers a diaper charismatic. In the end, it doesn't really matter whether you are passionate about what they do. The point is that they felt passionate about what they were doing, and the passion was deep and genuine. The key question for you is, what are you passionate about? What are you so passionate about that you can marry to what you can be the best in the world at, that you can marry to what drives your economics, that you can produce incredible results over time? This doesn't mean that you have to be passionate about the mechanics of the business per se, although you might be. The passion circle can be focused equally on what the company stands for. For example, during the 1980s, as Fannie Mae was coming out of its dark days, Fannie Mae people were not necessarily passionate about the mechanical process of packaging mortgages into market securities. But they were terrifically motivated by the whole idea of helping people of all classes, backgrounds, and races realize the American dream of owning their own home. Linda Knight, who joined Fannie Mae in 1983 just as the company faced its darkest days, told us, "This wasn't just any old company getting into trouble. This was a company at the core of making home ownership a reality for thousands of Americans. It's a role that's far more important than just making money. And that's why we felt such depth of commitment to preserve, protect, and enhance this company." As another Fannie Mae executive summed up, "I see us as a key mechanism for strengthening the whole social fabric of America." He continued, "Whenever I drive through difficult neighborhoods that are coming back because more families own their own homes, I return to work re-energized." Triumph of understanding over bravado. On the research team, we frequently found ourselves talking about the difference between pre-hedgehog and post-hedgehog states. In the pre-hedgehog state, it's like groping through the fog. You're making progress on a long march, but you can't see all that well. At each juncture in the trail, you can only see a little bit ahead, and you have to move at a deliberate, slow crawl. Then, with the hedgehog concept, you break into a clearing, the fog lifts, and you can see for miles. From then on, each juncture requires less deliberation, and you can shift from crawl to walk, from walk to run. In the post-hedgehog state, miles of trail move swiftly below your feet. Forks in the road fly past as you quickly make decisions that you could have not seen so clearly back in the fog. What's so striking about the comparison companies is that for all their change programs and frantic gesticulations and charismatic visionary leaders, they rarely emerged from the fog. They would try to run, making bad decisions at forks in the road, and then have to reverse course later. Or they would veer off the trail entirely, banging into trees and tumbling down ravines. Oh, but they were sure doing it with speed and panache. For the comparison companies, the exact same world, and keep in mind, they faced the exact same world, the same industry dynamics, the same forces, the same economics, that exact same world that had become so simple and clear to the good to great companies, somehow remained complex and shrouded in mist for the comparisons. Why? For two reasons. First, the comparison companies never ask the right questions. The questions prompted by the three circles. What are you deeply passionate about? What can you be the best in the world at? What best drives your economic engine? Second, they set their goals and strategies more from bravado than from understanding. Nowhere is this more evident than in the comparison company's mindless pursuit of growth. Over two-thirds of the comparison companies displayed an obsession with growth without the benefit of a hedgehog concept. Statements such as, "We've been a growth at any price company," and "betting that size equals success" pepper the materials on the comparison companies. In contrast, not one of the good to great companies focused obsessively on growth. Yet, the good to great companies created sustained, profitable growth far greater than the comparison companies that had made growth their mantra. Consider the case of Great Western and Fannie Mae. "Great Western is a mite unwieldy," wrote the Wall Street Transcript. "It wants to grow every way it can." The company found itself in finance, leasing, insurance, and manufactured houses, continually acquiring companies in an expansion binge. Bigger! More! In 1985, Great Western CEO told a gathering of analysts, "Don't worry about what you call us, a bank, a savings and loan, or a zebra." Quite a contrast to Fannie Mae during its best days of the transition under David Maxwell, which had a simple, crystalline understanding that it could be the best capital markets player in anything that related to mortgages, better even than Goldman Sachs or Solomon Brothers in opening up the full capital markets to the mortgage process. It built a powerful economic machine by reframing its business model on risk management rather than mortgage selling, and it drove the machine with great passion. The Fannie Mae people inspired by its vital role in democratizing home ownership. Until 1984, the stock charts tracked each other like mirror images. Then, in 1984, 1 year after it clarified its hedgehog concept, Fannie Mae exploded upward, while Great Western kept lollygagging along until just before its acquisition in 1997. By focusing on its simple, elegant conception, and not just focusing on growth and bigger and more and call us a zebra or whatever you want, Fannie Mae grew revenues nearly threefold from its transition year in 1984 through 1996. Great Western, for all its gobbling of growth steroids, grew revenues and earnings only 25% over the same period. Then it lost its independence in 1997. One focused on its hedgehog concept, the other obsessed on growth. The one that focused on its hedgehog concept outgrew the other by a huge margin. The Fannie Mae versus Great Western case from the 1980s highlights an essential point. Growth is not, cannot be a hedgehog concept. Rather, if you have the right hedgehog concept, and you make decisions relentlessly consistent with that concept, you will create such momentum that your main problem will not be how to grow, but how to not grow too fast. The hedgehog concept is a turning point in the journey from good to great. In most cases, the transition date follows within a few years of the hedgehog concept. Furthermore, everything from here on out in the book hinges upon having a hedgehog concept. As will become abundantly clear in the following chapters, disciplined action, the third big chunk in the framework after disciplined people and disciplined thought, only makes sense in the context of your hedgehog concept. Despite its vital importance, or rather, because of its vital importance, it would be a mistake to thoughtlessly attempt to jump right to a hedgehog concept. You just can't go off-site for 2 days, pull out a bunch of flip charts, do breakout sessions, and come up with deep understanding. Well, you can try to do that if you want, but you probably won't get it right, and in the end what matters is you have to get it right. It would be like Einstein saying, I think it's time to become a great scientist, so I'm going to go off to the Four Seasons this weekend, pull out the flip charts, and unlock the secrets of the universe. Insight just doesn't happen that way. It took Einstein a decade, 10 years of groping through the fog to get the theory of special relativity. And he was a bright guy. This is a critical point. It took about 4 years, not 4 months, not 4 weeks, not 4 days, 4 years on average for the good to great companies to clarify their hedgehog concepts. Like scientific insight, a hedgehog concept simplifies a complex world and makes decisions much easier. But while it has crystalline clarity and elegant simplicity once you have it, getting the concept can be devilishly difficult, and it almost always takes time. Recognize that getting a hedgehog concept is an inherently iterative process, never a single event. The essence of the process is to get the right people back to first who, then what? Get the right people engaged in vigorous dialogue and debate, infused with the brutal facts, and guided by questions formed by the three circles. Passion, best at, economics. Do we really understand what we can be the best in the world at, as distinct from what we can just be successful at? Do we really understand the drivers in our economic engine, including our economic denominator? Do we really understand what truly best ignites our passions? One particularly useful mechanism for moving the process along is a device that we came to call the council. The council consists of a group of the right people who participate in dialogue and debate guided by the three circles, iteratively over time about vital issues and decisions facing the organization. Now, I want you to think about what I just said. Notice how the other chapters start lining up at this point. You have a level 5 leader who assembles the right people who begin to engage in dialogue and debate infused with the brutal facts and then guided by the three circles of the hedgehog concept. Notice how the council becomes the mechanism for all these different chapters to start to come to place in one particular setting. In response to the question, how should we go about getting our hedgehog concept? On page 114 of the hardcover edition, we show a diagram which highlights or illustrates this iterative process. In the center of the diagram is the word the council. And then around that is a series of arrows going clockwise, which shows this iterative process. So it works like this. You ask questions guided by the three circles of members of the council. Then the council engages in dialogue and debate guided by the three circles. Then you take executive decisions, again, guided by the three circles. And then you do autopsies and analysis of how those decisions turned out, again, guided by the three circles, and you repeat the process. Questions, debate, decisions, autopsies, questions, debate, decisions, autopsies, until you get deeper and deeper understanding and you accumulate results over time. When asked, how do we accelerate the process of getting a hedgehog concept? Can we shorten the time from 4 years down to 3 or 2 or 1? I'd respond, increase the number of times you go round that full cycle in a given period of time. If you go through that cycle enough times, guided resolutely by those three circles, you will, in all likelihood, eventually gain the depth of understanding required for a hedgehog concept. But I must emphasize, it will not happen overnight. Now, wherever you are listening to this, you're probably wondering, well, who do I put on the council? How does the council work? What are the processes and mechanisms of the council? And I'd like to outline the key characteristics of a really strong council for you here so that you can begin thinking about putting together your own council. And just as an aside, even if you don't run the whole company, you can have a small council. You can have a council on your minibus in your own particular pocket of greatness. Everybody can build a council, even at a personal level. I have a personal board of directors, which serves as my own individual personal council in my own life. The council mechanism is a generic idea. Here are the characteristics of the council. 1. The council exists as a device to gain understanding about important issues. 2. The council usually consists of 5 to 12 people. 3. Each council member has the ability and desire to argue and debate in search of understanding, not from an egoistic need to win a point or to protect his or her parochial interest. 4. Each council member retains the respect of every other council member without exception. That's a very important point in the council. Each and every council member has to hold the respect of every other council member without exception. Tall order. 5. Council members come from a range of perspectives, but each member has knowledge about some aspect of the environment or dilemmas you face. 6. The council includes key members of the management team, but is not limited to members of the management team, nor is every executive automatically a member. 7. The council is a standing body. It's not an ad hoc committee assembled for a specific project. You never shut down the council. It's always there. 8. The council meets periodically, as much as once a week or as infrequently as once per quarter, but no less. 9. The council does not seek consensus, recognizing that consensus decisions are often at odds with intelligent decisions. 10. The council is an informal body, not listed on any formal organization chart or in any formal documents. 11. The council can have a range of possible names. We found in our research that the council often had an innocuous name. Things like the Long Range Profit Improvement Committee, the Corporate Products Committee, the Strategic Thinking Group, and the Executive Council. In some ways, the more innocuous the name, the more powerful the group. Does every organization have a hedgehog concept to discover? What if you wake up, look around with brutal honesty, and conclude, we're not the best at anything, and we never have been? Therein lies one of the most exciting aspects of the entire Good to Great study. In the majority of cases, the Good to Great companies, well, they were not the best in the world at anything either, and showed no prospects of becoming so. That's the whole point. They were good to great. They weren't just great. Infused with the Stockdale paradox, there must be something we can become the best at, and we will find it. We must also confront the brutal facts of what we cannot be the best at, and we will not delude ourselves. Infused with this paradox, every good to great company, no matter how awful at the start of the process, and some of the companies like Nucor were truly awful, prevailed in the search for a hedgehog concept. As you search for your own concept, keep in mind that when the good to great companies finally grasped their hedgehog concept, it had none of the tiresome, irritating blasts of mindless bravado typical of comparison companies. Yep, we could become the best at that, was stated as a recognition of fact, no more startling than observing that the sky is blue or the grass is green. When you get your hedgehog concept right, it has the quiet ping of truth, like a single, clear, perfectly struck note hanging in the air in the hushed silence of a full auditorium at the end of a quiet movement of a Mozart piano concerto. There is no need to say much of anything. The quiet truth speaks for itself. As I bring this chapter to a close, I'm reminded of a personal experience in my own family that illustrates the vital difference between bravado, beating on your chest, and quiet understanding. My wife Joanne began racing marathons and triathlons in the early 1980s. As she gained experience, running on the track and getting her swim splits and race results, she began to feel the momentum of success. One day, she entered a race with many of the best women triathletes in the world, and despite a weak swim, in fact, when she came out of the water, I was so finally surprised to see her, I thought she'd maybe drowned out there. She came out hundreds of places behind the top swimmers and began to push this huge, heavy, non-aerodynamic bike up a long hill. And despite all of this, she managed to cross the finish line in the top 10. Then a few weeks later, we're sitting at breakfast, and Joanne put down her morning paper and calmly, quietly looked across the table at me and said, "I think I could win the Ironman." The Ironman, the world championship of triathlons, involves 2.4 miles of ocean swimming and 112 miles of cycling, capped off with a 26.2-mile marathon foot race on the hot, lava-baked Kona coast of Hawaii. "Of course, I'd have to quit my job," she continued. "Turn down my offers to graduate school." She'd in fact been admitted at that point to graduate business schools at a number of the top schools. "And commit to full-time training. But I think I could win the Ironman." Her words had no bravado in them. No hype. No agitation. No pleading. She didn't try to convince me. She simply observed what she had come to understand was a fact, a truth no more shocking than stating that The walls were painted white. It's as if she looked up from her morning newspaper and said, "Jim, you're sitting in a chair." "Jim, I think I could win the Ironman." She had the passion. She had the genetics. And if she won races, she'd have the economics. The goal to win the Ironman flowed from an early understanding of her hedgehog concept at that time. And so, she decided to go for it. She quit her job. She turned down the graduate schools. She sold the mills. But I have to say, fortunately, she did keep me on her bus. And 3 years later, on a hot October day in 1985, she did indeed cross the finish line at the Hawaii Ironman in first place, world champion. When Joanne set out to win the Ironman, she did not know if she would, in fact, become the world's best woman triathlete. But she understood that it was possible, that she could, that it was something that she could do without being delusional. And that distinction makes all the difference. It's a distinction that those who want to go from good to great must grasp, and one that those who fail to become great so often never do. Chapter summary, The Hedgehog Concept. To go from good to great requires a deep understanding of three intersecting circles translated into a simple crystalline concept that we came to call the hedgehog concept. The key is to understand what your organization can be the best in the world at, and equally, what it cannot be the best at. Not what it wants to be the best at, not what it hopes to be the best at, not what it aims to be the best at, but that calm, non-bravado understanding of what it can be the best at. The hedgehog concept is not a goal, strategy, or intention. It's an understanding. If you cannot be the best in the world at your core business, then your core business cannot form the basis of your hedgehog concept. The best in the world understanding is a much more severe standard than core competence. You might have a competence, but not necessarily have the capacity to be the truly best in the world at that competence. Conversely, there may be activities at which you could become the best in the world, but at which you have no current competence. To get insight into the drivers of your economic engine, search for the one denominator, profit per X, or perhaps in the social sector, cash flow per X, that has the single greatest impact. As I'm recording this in 2005, a number of years after we wrote the book, I've done a lot of thinking about the social sector and the application of these ideas. And the hedgehog concept very much applies to the social sector. And again, think about the hedgehog concept as three circles: passion, best at, and then the third circle in a business sector is economics or profit per X. Obviously, in the social sector, you can't think of it as profit per X because most social sector organizations don't have profits. Or even if they do, the point is not profit. So what you want to think about if you're a social sector organization is it's still the three circles and it's still having a hedgehog, but it's a slight change. You have passion and best at. Those two circles are essential. But the third circle shifts from being an economic circle, an economic engine, to a resource engine. And the resource engine consists of three sub-pieces: money, time, meaning volunteers, people giving willingly, and brand, your reputation that gives people the confidence to support your organization in the absence of measurable external results. Consider, for example, an organization like the Red Cross. The Red Cross has a brand reputation that when a world disaster happens, and we've seen any number of disasters from 9/11 to the big tsunami that hit in Southeast Asia, we want to give, but we don't always know how to give. But there's a certain confidence that if we give to the Red Cross, and there are other organizations like this too, that they will make good use of the funds. We can't measure it. We can't see it. There aren't stock returns. But we have faith because of the Red Cross brand. The Red Cross brand also, and the Red Cross organization, attracts volunteers, which gives it time. And then, of course, there's the money piece that ties into it, and in their case, also the blood business. And you put those three together and you say, what's the resource engine? That third circle for the Red Cross, we have money, we have time, and we have its brand. Now, returning back to the original text, in the summary for the hedgehog concept, good to great companies set their goals and strategies based on understanding. Comparison companies, we found, set their goals and strategies more based on chest-beating bravado. Getting the hedgehog concept is an iterative process. The council can be a useful device. As always, there are some unexpected findings. The good to great companies are more like hedgehogs, simple, dowdy creatures that know one big thing and stick to it. The comparison companies are more like foxes, crafty, cunning creatures that know many things, yet lack consistency. It took 4 years on average for the good to great companies to get their hedgehog concept. Strategy, per se, meaning having a strategy or not having a strategy, did not separate the good to great companies from the comparison companies. Both sets of companies had strategies. And there's no evidence that the good to great companies spent more time on strategic planning or strategic thinking than the comparison companies. You absolutely do not need to be in a great industry to produce sustained great results. No matter how bad the industry, every good to great company figured out how to produce truly superior economic returns. Remember the point all the way back in chapter 1. Greatness is not primarily a function of circumstance. Greatness is first and foremost a function of conscious choice and discipline. Before we move into the next chapter, the chapter on discipline, the culture of discipline, I'd like to quickly deal with a question that has come up many times since we first published Good to Great. That question has to do with, well, can a diversified company or a diversified organization be a hedgehog? Can you be in multiple businesses and be a hedgehog? The answer to that is something that wasn't in the original text, but is a helpful distinction. Turns out there are two types of hedgehogs. There are content hedgehogs, and there are process hedgehogs. A content hedgehog is a hedgehog where the hedgehog concept has to do with the actual business activity. Take Walgreens. Walgreens is a classic content hedgehog. The best, most convenient drugstores, steadily increasing profit per customer visit. It's all about the content of drugstores. That's its one big thing. But let's take a company like GE, General Electric, which is in all kinds of businesses, from jet engines and television and insurance and all kinds of things. Is GE therefore a fox rather than a hedgehog? And how would we square that with the fact that GE is in fact an enduring great company? The answer lies in the fact that GE is a process hedgehog. Now, a process hedgehog is one where you have an underlying process that is the one big thing that can be deployed into multiple types of content. So, let's think about it. What can GE be the best in the world at, and in fact has been the best in the world at for nearly 100 years? Developing executive talent and deploying it into good businesses to produce great results. The key process is developing executive talent. And what would GE's economic engine be? Well, ultimately, it's profit per unit of executive talent. And what is GE most passionate about? Oh, they are passionate about having the best executive development machine since the Roman legions. So what is GE's hedgehog concept and what has been its hedgehog concept for 100 years? The best in the world at developing executive talent, deploying it in good businesses to produce great results, steadily increasing profit per unit of executive talent. So notice there, Walgreens is a content hedgehog. GE is a process hedgehog. They are both hedgehogs. The question for you at the beginning of this is, are you a content or a process hedgehog? Chapter 6, A culture of discipline. Freedom is only part of the story and half the truth. That is why I recommend that the Statue of Liberty on the East Coast be supplemented with a Statue of Responsibility on the West Coast. Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning. In 1980, George Rathman co-founded the biotechnology company Amgen. Over the next 20 years, Amgen grew from a struggling entrepreneurial enterprise into a $3.2 billion company with 6,400 employees, creating blood products to improve the lives of people suffering through chemotherapy and kidney dialysis. Under Rathman, Amgen became one of the few biotechnology companies that delivered consistent profitability and growth. It became so consistently profitable, in fact, that its stock price multiplied over 150 times from its public offering in June 1983 to January 2000. An investor who bought as little as $7,000 in Amgen stock would have realized a capital gain of over $1 million, 13 times better than the same investment in the general stock market. Few successful startups become great companies, in large part because they respond to growth and success in the wrong way. Entrepreneurial success is fueled by creativity, imagination, bold moves into uncharted waters, and visionary zeal. As the company grows and becomes more complex, it begins to trip over its own success. Too many new people, too many new customers, too many new orders, too many new products. What was once great fun becomes an unwieldy ball of disorganized stuff. Lack of planning, lack of accounting, lack of systems, and lack of hiring constraints creates friction. Problems surface with customers, with cash flow, with schedules. In response, someone, often a board member, says, "It's time to grow up. This place needs some professional management." The company begins to hire MBAs and seasoned executives from blue-chip companies. Processes, procedures, checklists, and all the rest begin to sprout up like weeds. What was once an egalitarian environment gets replaced with a hierarchy. Chains of command appear for the first time, reporting relationships become clear, and an executive class with special perks begins to appear. We and they segmentations appear, just like a real company. The professional managers, often referred to as the suits, finally rein in the mess. They create order out of chaos, but all too often they also kill the entrepreneurial spirit. Members of the founding team begin to grumble, "This just isn't fun anymore. I used to be able to just get things done. Now I have to fill out a form or to follow these stupid rules. Worst of all, I have to spend a horrendous amount of time in useless meetings." The creative magic begins to wane as some of the most innovative people leave, disgusted by the burgeoning bureaucracy and hierarchy. The exciting startup becomes just another company, with nothing special to recommend it. The cancer of mediocrity begins to grow in earnest. Now back to Amgen. George Rathman at Amgen avoided this entrepreneurial death spiral. He understood that the purpose of bureaucracy is to compensate for incompetence and lack of discipline, a problem that largely goes away if you have the right people in the first place. Most companies build their bureaucratic rules to manage the small percentage of the wrong people on the bus. Well, what does that do? That in turn drives away the right people on the bus, which then increases the total percentage of wrong people on the bus, which then increases the need for, guess what, more bureaucracy to compensate for incompetence and lack of discipline because you've got a higher percentage of the wrong people on the bus, which then further drives the right people away, and the percentage of wrong people goes up again, and so you need more bureaucracy to deal with the incompetence of the wrong people, and then more of the right people leave, and you are in a downward spiral. Rathman understood that there's an alternative. Avoid bureaucracy and hierarchy, and instead create a culture of discipline. When you put these two complementary forces together, a culture of discipline and an ethic of entrepreneurship, you get a magical alchemy of superior performance and sustained results. Why are we starting this chapter with a biotechnology entrepreneur rather than one of our good to great companies? Because George Rathman credits much of his entrepreneurial success to what he learned while working at Abbott Laboratories before he founded Amgen. Let me share with you a quote from Rathman, and I'd like you to think about the discipline in your own organization as you listen to this quote. What I got from Abbott was the idea that when you set your objectives for the year, you record them in concrete. You can change your plans through the year, but you never change what you measure yourself against. You are rigorous at the end of the year, adhering exactly to what you said was going to happen. You don't get a chance to editorialize. You don't get a chance to adjust and finagle and decide, well, you really didn't intend to do that anyway, and readjust your objectives to make yourself look better. You never just focus on what you've accomplished for the year. You focus on what you've accomplished relative to exactly what you said you are going to accomplish, no matter how tough the measure. That was a discipline learned at Abbott and that we carried into Amgen. Many of the Abbott disciplines trace back to 1968 when it hired a remarkable financial officer named Bernard H. Semler. Semler did not see his job as a traditional financial controller or accountant. Rather, he set out to invent mechanisms that would drive cultural change. Now think about this. This is the finance guy seeing his job as to create mechanisms that would drive cultural change. That's remarkable. He created a whole new framework of accounting that he called responsibility accounting, wherein every item of cost, income, and investment would be clearly identified with a single, specific, identified individual responsible, capital R, responsible for that item. The idea, radical for the 1960s, was to create a system wherein every Abbott manager in every type of job was responsible for his or her return on investment with the same rigor that an investor holds an entrepreneur responsible. There would be no hiding behind traditional accounting allocations, no slopping funds from here to there to cover up ineffective management, no opportunities for finger pointing. But the beauty of the Abbott system lay not just in its rigor, but in how it used rigor and discipline to enable creativity, to enable entrepreneurship. Abbott developed a very disciplined organization, but not in a linear way of thinking, said Rathman. It was exemplary at having both financial discipline and the divergent thinking of creative work. We used financial discipline as a way to provide resources for the really creative work. Abbott reduced its administrative costs as a percentage of sales to the lowest in the industry by a significant margin, and at the same time became a new product innovation machine like 3M, deriving up to 65% of revenues from new products introduced in the previous 4 years. Now think about this next time somebody says, which do you want, low cost or high innovation? Both. This creative duality ran through every aspect of Abbott during the transition era, woven into the fabric of the corporate culture. On the one hand, Abbott recruited entrepreneurial leaders and gave them freedom to determine the best path to achieving their objectives. On the other hand, individuals had to commit fully to the Abbott system and were held rigorously accountable for those objectives. They had freedom, but freedom in a framework. Abbott instilled the entrepreneur's zeal for opportunistic flexibility. We recognized that planning is priceless, but plans are useless, said one Abbott executive, quoting, I believe, Dwight D. Eisenhower. But Abbott also had the discipline to say no to opportunities that failed the Three Circles test. While encouraging wide-ranging innovation within its divisions, Abbott simultaneously maintained fanatical adherence to its hedgehog concept of contributing to cost-effective healthcare. You could innovate, but you had to stay within the hedgehog. Abbott exemplifies a key finding in our study, a culture of discipline. By its nature, culture is a somewhat unwieldy topic to discuss, less prone to clean frameworks like the Three Circles. The main points of this chapter, however, boil down to one central idea. Build a culture full of people, the right people on the bus, first two, then what? So build a culture full of the right people who take disciplined action within the Three Circles, fanatically consistent with the hedgehog concept. More precisely, this means the following four points. One, build a culture around the idea of freedom and responsibility within a framework. Two, fill that culture with self-disciplined people who are willing to go to extreme lengths to fulfill their responsibilities. They will rinse their cottage cheese, which I will explain in a few minutes. Three, don't confuse a culture of discipline with a tyrannical disciplinarian. And four, adhere with great consistency to the hedgehog concept, exercising an almost religious focus on the intersection of the Three Circles. Equally important, create a stop doing list and systematically unplug anything extraneous. Freedom and responsibility within a framework. Picture an airline pilot. She settles into the cockpit, surrounded by dozens of complicated switches and sophisticated gauges, sitting atop a massive $84 million piece of machinery. As passengers thump and stuff their bags into overhead bins and flight attendants scurry about trying to get everyone settled in, she begins her pre-flight checklist. Step by methodical step, she systematically moves through every required item. Cleared for departure, she begins working with air traffic control, following precise instructions, which direction to take out of the gate, which way to taxi, which runway to use, which direction to take off. She doesn't throttle up and hurtle the jet into the air until she's cleared for takeoff. Once aloft, she communicates continually with flight control centers and stays within the tight boundaries of the commercial air traffic system. On approach, however, she hits a ferocious thunder and lightning storm. Blasting winds, crossways and unpredictable, tilt the wings down to the left and then down to the right. Looking out the windows, passengers can't see the ground, only the thinning and thickening globs of gray clouds and spatter of rain on the windows. The flight attendants announce, "Ladies and gentlemen, we've been asked to remain seated for the remainder of the flight. Please put your seats in the upright and locked position and place all your carry-on baggage under the seat in front of you. We should be on the ground shortly." Not too shortly, I hope, think the less experienced travelers, unnerved by the roiling wind and momentary flashes of lightning. But the experienced travelers just go on reading magazines, chatting with seatmates, and preparing for their meetings on the ground. "I've been through all this before," they think. She'll only land if it's safe. Sure enough, on final approach, wheels down as 250,000 pounds of aluminum glide down at 130 miles per hour, passengers suddenly hear the engines whine and feel themselves thrust back into their seats. The plane accelerates back into the sky. It banks around in a big arc back toward the airport. The pilot takes a moment to click on the intercom. "Sorry, folks, we were getting some bad crosswinds there. We're going to give it another try." On the next go, the winds calm just enough, and she brings the plane down safely. Now step back and think about the model here. The pilot operates within a very strict system, and she does not have freedom to go outside of that system. You don't want airline pilots saying, "Hey, I just read in a management book about the value of being empowered, freedom to experiment, to be creative, to be entrepreneurial, to try a lot of stuff and keep what works." At least not on airplanes that I want to fly. Yet at the same time, the crucial decisions, whether to take off, whether to land, whether to abort, whether to land elsewhere, rest with the pilot. Regardless of the strictures of the system, one central fact stands out above the others. The pilot has ultimate responsibility for the airplane and the lives of the people on that plane. The point here is not that a company should have a system as strict and inflexible as the air traffic system. After all, if a corporate system fails, people don't die by the hundreds in burning twisted hunks of steel. Customer service at the airlines might be terrible, but you are almost certain to get where you are going in one piece. The point of this analogy is that when we looked inside the good to great companies, we were reminded of the best part of that airline pilot model. Freedom and responsibility within the framework of a highly developed system. The good to great companies built a consistent system with clear constraints, but they also gave people freedom and responsibility within the framework of that system. They hired self-disciplined people who didn't need to be managed. And then they managed the system, not the people. After reflecting on the book for 4 years before re-recording it, that sentence comes back to me as one of the most important. Let me repeat. They hired self-disciplined people who didn't need to be managed and then managed the system, not the people. This was the secret to how we were able to run stores from a great distance by remote control, said Bill Rivas of Circuit City. It was a combination of great store managers who had ultimate responsibility for their individual stores operating within a great system. You've got to have management and people who believe in the system and who do whatever is necessary to make the system work. But within the boundaries of that system, store managers had a lot of leeway to coincide with their responsibility. In the 1980s, when Circuit City hit its breakthrough, it became to consumer electronics retailing what McDonald's became to restaurants. Not the most exquisite experience, but an enormously consistent one. As the company struggled after the year 2000, it came in part because they lost some of these disciplines. Whether the company comes back as great depends on whether they are able to get that same discipline back. The system evolved over time, as Circuit City experimented by adding new items like computers and video players, just like McDonald's added breakfast egg McMuffins. But at any given moment, everyone operated within the framework of the system. That's one of the major differences between us and all the others who were in the same business in the early 1980s, said Bill Zierden. They just couldn't roll it out further. And we could. We could stamp these stores out all over the country with great consistency. And therein lies one of the key reasons why Circuit City took off in the early 1980s and beat the general market by more than 18 times over the next 15 years. In a sense, much of this book is about creating a culture of discipline. It all starts with disciplined people. The transition begins not by trying to discipline the wrong people into the right behaviors, again, first who, then what, but by getting self-disciplined people on the bus in the first place. Next, we have disciplined thought. You need the discipline to confront the brutal facts of reality, while retaining resolute faith that you can, and you will, create a path to greatness. Most important, you need the discipline to persist in the search for understanding until you get your hedgehog concept. And now, finally, we have disciplined action, the primary subject of this chapter. The order is important. The comparison companies often tried to jump right to disciplined action. But disciplined action, without self-disciplined people, is impossible to sustain. And disciplined action, without disciplined thought, is a recipe for disaster. Discipline by itself will not produce great results. We find plenty of organizations, even societies in history, that had tremendous discipline and that marched right into disaster. with precision and in nicely formed lines. The point is to first get self-disciplined people who engage in very rigorous thinking, who then take disciplined action within the framework of a consistent system designed around the hedgehog concept. Throughout the research, we were struck by the continued use of words like disciplined, rigorous, dogged, determined, diligent, precise, fastidious, systematic, methodical, workmanlike, demanding, consistent, focused, accountable, and responsible. These words peppered articles, interviews, and source materials on the Good to Great companies, and were strikingly absent from the materials on the direct comparison companies. People in the Good to Great companies became somewhat extreme in the fulfillment of their responsibilities, bordering, quite frankly, in some cases on fanaticism. We came to call this rinsing your cottage cheese. The analogy comes from a disciplined world-class athlete named Dave Scott, who won the Hawaii Ironman triathlon 6 times. In training, Scott would ride his bike 75 miles, swim 20,000 meters, and run 17 miles on average every single day. Dave Scott did not have a weight problem. Yet, he believed that a low-fat, high-carbohydrate diet would give him an extra edge. So Dave Scott, a man who burned at least 5,000 calories a day in training, would literally rinse his cottage cheese, stand there at a sink, rinsing his cottage cheese to get off the extra fat. Now, there's no evidence that he absolutely needed to rinse his cottage cheese to win the Ironman. That's not the point of the story. The point is that rinsing his cottage cheese was simply one more small step that he believed would make him just that much better. One more small step added to all the other small steps to create a consistent program of super discipline. I've always had this picture of Dave Scott running the 26 miles of the marathon, hammering away in 100 degree heat with no shade on those baked lava fields, after swimming 2.4 miles in the ocean and cycling 112 miles against ferocious crosswinds, pounding his way into the finish line and thinking to himself, compared to rinsing my cottage cheese every day, this just isn't that bad. I realize this is a bizarre analogy, but in a sense, the Good to Great companies became a lot like Dave Scott. Much of the answer to the question of good to great lies in the discipline to do whatever it takes to become the best within carefully selected arenas and then to seek continual improvement from there. In many ways, it's really just that simple. And it's just that difficult. Everyone would like to be the best, but most lack the discipline to figure out with egoless clarity what they can be the best at. And they lack the will to do whatever it takes to turn that potential into reality. They lack the discipline to rinse their cottage cheese. Consider Wells Fargo in contrast to Bank of America. Carl Reichardt never doubted that Wells Fargo could emerge from bank deregulation as a stronger company, not a weaker one. He saw that the key to becoming a great company rested not with brilliant new strategies, but with the sheer determination to rip 100 years of banker mentality out of the system. "There's too much waste in banking," said Reichert. "Getting rid of it takes tenacity, not brilliance." Reichert set a clear tone at the top. "We're not going to ask everyone else to suffer while we sit on high. We will start by rinsing our own cottage cheese right here in the executive offices." He froze executive salaries for 2 years, despite the fact that Wells Fargo was enjoying some of the most profitable years in its history. He shut the executive dining room and replaced it with a college dorm food service caterer. He closed the executive elevator, sold the corporate jets, and banned green plants from the executive suite as too expensive to water. He removed free coffee from the executive suite. He eliminated Christmas trees for management. He threw reports back at people who had submitted them in fancy binders with the admonishment, "Would you spend your own money this way? What does a binder have to do with anything?" Reichert would sit through meetings with fellow executives in a beat-up old chair with the stuffing hanging out. Sometimes, he would just sit there and pick